You're the director, right?
I'm the director of the Center for Community Self-Help.
This is an interview on October 19th with Martin Eakes, the director of the... Center for Community Self-Help. I wonder if you could briefly just begin with a brief biography, autobiography, about how you came to this position and then a little bit about the credit union and how it works.
I grew up in Greensboro, in a predominantly black community during desegregation, where this kind of salient facts for me. My friends were all black, and basically over time, most of my friends were destroyed in one form or another. Several have been killed, several have been jailed, and so somewhere along there, I became really interested in social justice types of issues. A story just that gives a little flavor of who I am was I played Little League football on a church football team in downtown Greensboro, and half of my fellow teammates were African American. And I can remember as an 11-year-old taking my friends to join the church, this white sort of country club Baptist church, and the church would not permit them to join as members. So I've basically been fighting to have people be able to get into churches and get into places that they were excluded from ever since. I would have been a jazz trumpet player or a physicist if the world were a better place. That would be my real true love. And basically, I went to law school with the thought of coming out and doing civil rights work. And the statement of how self-help got started, which started out of the back of a trunk, literally with a couple of people with no budget, no pay. Our stated vision was to try to take the civil rights movement and the women's movement and translate them out of the legal arena and into the economic arena. That basically many of the battles for civil rights had already been fought and won, but that they were irrelevant if they had no impact in the economic arena. A couple of facts in the background that kind of motivate the work of self-help getting started was the discovery that we found that in African American communities there were only 1/10 as many businesses existing as there were in white communities. We kept asking ourselves, why is this true? And I had people tell me, they said, well, it's because black businesses fail more frequently. And I said, well, that's possible, let me go check it out. And I checked out the data and found that that was false, that black and white businesses fail at exactly the same rate, no statistical difference whatsoever. So I came back and I refused, having grown up in a black community, to believe that it was a lack of entrepreneurial drive. Whatever else anyone could say, my community and the friends I grew up with had incredible entrepreneurial talent. And so we were very slow learners. It took us 4 or 5 years to finally discover what has become a real key fact, and that is that in North Carolina, which is true for the country as a whole, black families have, on average, net wealth of approximately $4,000. The net wealth of white households is approximately $44,000 on average. So there's a 10-to-1 difference in wealth, exactly the same order of magnitude of the difference in number of businesses and communities. And so while we can, as a society, say that we have come so far from slavery and that we now have African-American jobs earning 70 cents on the dollar, so we're 70% of the way. The truth is, in terms of a measurement of wealth, we have only come 10% of the way from slavery. Poor whites in North Carolina face exactly the same problem. Federal government policy and most media think of poverty as being low income. They forget that there is intergenerational wealth transfer that takes place between family, within a family, and that problems of 100 years ago do get transmitted with exceptions. I mean, people jump out, people fall back in, but all of our federal policy programs focus on income, from food stamps to welfare, and income is only one half, if that much, of the problems of poverty. Wealth has a real big key to it. So self-help got started basically as a group of activists who had no intention ever of being bankers or lenders or anything else, with the notion that the way to make dialogue, to create dialogue between white and black, is to have people have a joint stake, a joint ownership in enterprises. And so for the first 4 years, 5 years of self-help's existence, 1980 to 1985, we worked with industrial plants that were owned by families or by larger entities that wanted to sell them to the employees. And we worked to create, I think we had maybe 40 businesses of some form that got started during that period, and roughly half of them survived for a period of time and half of them failed reasonably quickly. But the common thread was, how do you bring people who have been divided, either because of being poor versus rich, or black versus white, or young versus old, and have them have a common ownership in a business such that they basically are on the same side of some imaginary line? And that basically was the vision and philosophy of self-help getting started. One more quick story, and then we'll get into white furniture. We found that we were spending most of our time trying to arrange financing for these efforts, that there was an incredible amount of interest. Every industrial plant, North Carolina had an economy much like the Rust Belt, in that we had between 1980 and 1982 somewhere around 60 to 100 industrial plants that shut down each year. No other southern state was anywhere close to that number. And about a third of those would call us asking if we could help to somehow figure out a way of having the employees buy the plant. And we would work with maybe three a year, so 10% of the requests that we get. One of the very earliest projects we worked with was a textile plant that shut down in New Bern, North Carolina. It had a workforce of about 400 people, and there was a small core of people, about 5 to 10 former employees who were almost all black, all over 55 years of age, many of whom were disabled during World War II, who basically said, if we don't start and do our own business, we have absolutely no chance of ever being hired in a rural town in North Carolina. And the primary person, his name was Percy White, who helped push that along, had no money, no wealth, no family he could call on to start a small business. So he started selling liquid carpet cleaner, you know, the kind of stuff that comes in the orange jugs that they sell for high school fundraisers. And he sold that for 18 months door to door in New Bern to raise $1,500 to buy his first oven. And he called me one time and said, I'm coming to the VA hospital in Durham, and Martin, I want you to come see me. This is 1981, 82, somewhere in there. And I went to see him. He was not even out of anesthesia yet. And I'm thinking, well, it's going to be like visiting my grandmother. And he reached up and grabbed me by the lapel and pulled me down close to his face. And he says, Martin, he says, if you can help me get $1,700 more, I can start. And he's literally, he's groggy still with anesthesia. And the people who worked at self-help at that time pooled, I think we had a total budget of about $10,000. We pooled our salary funds and made him a loan of $1,700. So it was our first self-help's first loan. He started his bakery. He succeeded. We had a conference, and he brought one of the first cakes that the bakery made and raffled it, and had $77 for the raffled cake. And he delivered the $77 to me and said, "Martin, I want this to be the first money for the self-help credit union, so that no one will ever have to sell liquid carpet cleaner door to door to get a business started just because they're black or poor or rural or disabled." So that is the kind of spiritual legacy of self-help. And so this year we passed self-help credit union. The combined self-help has total lending assets of $77 million. So we've had a million-fold increase from that that first cake. And we passed somewhere around $60 million of community development loans that have been made in the last 10 years with a track record and a repayment record better than any of the major banks in North Carolina. So I'm proud of the borrowers. I mean, I think that no one says to me anymore what they did 10 years ago, which is that if there is a viable project, we are making loans to them. There are no people falling through the cracks. No one even says that anymore because they know it's false. So we're basically old-time preachers, soapbox preachers.
Well, that's excuse me. That's a wonderful tale. Now, if you could just tell us how you first heard about White Furniture Factory, and then if that was before you first heard about the buyout, tell us about that, and then when you first heard about
let's see if I can get all the sequences together. Okay. There were two members of the White extended family who knew of self-help and knew our work to create worker buyouts of factories. One was Zan White, who I think you've talked to, and the other was Carter Garber. Can't remember which called first, but basically they were the two who were in some ways, you know, the black sheep of that family. I mean, they were activists within that extended family. And basically said, "We have, as a family business, Martin, you never knew this, that, you know, because at least at that age, people whose background was, you know, connected to some kind of wealth or, but who were in the activist community, they didn't advertise that so much." And said, "We have this connection, and our families are shareholders in a factory that looks to be having problems, and that it is having losses for the first time in its 100-year plus history. And is there anything that self-help's programs could be useful in helping with?" Well, it was a larger venture than any we had actually invested in the past, although we had worked with ones that were 100 and 200 people. This was, I don't even remember the exact size now, but it was 600 or 800. I mean, it was bigger. So we started having a discussion probably a year or two before the buyout.
If I can clarify one point. Now, were Zan White and Carter Garber interested in you helping the White family or helping the workers actually buy the plant from the Whites?
I don't think there was any real view of that being a division.
Oh, okay.
If the workers could buy it, that would be a benefit for as a way of saving. This was a time where industrial plants were shutting down all over.
And the call was made, was the company clearly for sale or about to be for sale, or were they?
The very first conversations were, I don't think it was for sale at all. It was simply the challenge that self-help had found during its first 2 or 3 years was that by the time a business had already shut down or was close to shutting down, there was no chance to salvage at that point. Once some of your strong employees have left, Once your customers have started moving to other places, once your vendors have lost confidence in you, it's basically an avalanche. And you have to identify an opportunity for employees to buy a firm very early.
Okay.
And Zan and Carter had heard me preaching that message for at least a couple of years. And so I think they were saying, well, here is this may or it may not be. I mean, I don't think they knew they didn't have the authority to speak for their families. Mm-hmm. But they had that interest. And so there was some trading of information, but it was a very low-key and not very proactive until some point. And I don't remember exactly what the catalyst point was, and I can't remember the exact timing of the chronology. But basically the two White Furniture families, the White's extended family and the Millinders, were starting to come to real conflict as a shareholder group. And some of that was focused on the issue of transferring management control from the older generation to the younger. And basically my perception at that time was that the Millinders, who I had virtually no contact with, I never had any substantial contact with the Millinder family, did not have confidence in the younger generation of the Whites that would probably come to focus primarily on Sam White. So there was a substantial minority stock ownership position that wanted to sell the business as a way of avoiding what they were starting to see as a decline in the fortunes and profitability of White Furniture Company, which had always had substantial profitability throughout its history, I believe. And it was at that point that we really got called in as a viable option to think about, is there a way that the employees can buy out? And I can't remember whether the, what's the guy's name? The Chicago financier,
Clyde Engel.
Clyde Engel. Can't remember whether he was in the picture yet or not. The learning that self-help had over the years was that the absolutely critical piece to having any worker buyout succeed was having a very strong, committed chief executive. It's the key to any organization succeeding, whether it's a college, a nonprofit, a small business. I, at that time, wanted to, didn't believe that. I wanted everything to be egalitarian, that any person, if you give them the ingredients, can at that point in time be a successful manager of a business. But that I was wrong. I mean, my ideology was. So we recruited a person.
Are those usually recruited from outside rather than from within the current management structure?
It depends. I mean, you can use it, basically say a business that is prospering quite well probably has the leadership internal to the business to run it. One that is starting to decline probably doesn't. It's just that simple. But that is my 40 businesses that I worked with over those first 4 or 5 years, the ones that failed and the ones succeeded, there was no difference in the markets they were in, and the types of hurdles they faced, in any single factor except for the skill, tenaciousness, stubbornness of the leader in the project. That we found people who were in tough markets and facing really tough challenges with a strong enough person would still find a way to make it uphill. And those that had weak leadership, no matter how clear the path, no matter how big the market, they would find a way to bump their heads on an overhang on the way down the mountain. People who were in lending, in business school, and bankers, I mean, the sort of traditional business world would have already known, they already knew that. But as younger idealists, we were not prepared to accept that at that point. They were right, and we were learning on that score.
So you started to say that you, it sounded like you were about to describe your search for a viable CEO.
Well, we had identified a person that we knew to have really exceptional talent, someone I went to college with who then had gone to Harvard Business School, had been several years in a very high-powered consulting firm in Cleveland. His name's Crawford Crenshaw. I mentioned his name to you. And I called Crawford and asked him if he wanted to run his own business. This guy has unlimited talent and really a very, very strong person, but he's young. And he's hobnobbed with the CEOs of the Fortune 25 and really big companies. And he basically said, that's exactly what I'd love to do. I'm willing to explore it. And basically he committed that if some kind of worker buyout could take place at White Furniture, that he would come in and be the manager, which is a very risky role. I mean, you have some democratic processes in place so that weak management can be thrown out by the folks who work there. So it's a little bit tenuous.
Before we move forward and talk about Crawford and Crenshaw a little bit, I'm curious. You had said that when you were contacted by the Whites, that they had said this company's in trouble and help us, you know, approach this, help us deal with this. Did they elaborate or did they share any other information, more technical information with you at the time to help you sort of assess where White Furniture was? Or did you do any preliminary research before you contacted Crawford to see what the financial situation was at White Furniture?
I can't remember the chronology, but we basically got if you're doing an assessment of a buyout of any sort, what you need are historical financial statements. And I think the early conversations we had, it was not the White family in its institutional sense that had contacted us. It was two children who were really not in positions of power who contacted me. And at some later date, so there was a discussion and there really was no follow-up with that because it wasn't at a point where there was really much interest from the real powers within the White family. It was probably a year later, and I can't remember the dates exactly. I mean, you could probably refresh me of what happened at what date, and I can place them before or after. That I think it was Zan who probably got me financial statements for a 5 or 10 year period preceding. So we analyzed it. It was a very simple company. I mean, in a sense, it's a simple business to analyze on the surface, and then much more difficult to analyze a level deeper. The first analysis of White Furniture was to say, what has been the profitability trend, what has been the sales trends, and try to analyze those numbers. And what those numbers showed was that the business had been stable and profitable, but that it had was moving in the wrong direction in terms of profits, so that the Millenders had a legitimate fear, I believe, of what might be the future of that company. There were also the trends that businesses that were located around the I-85 corridor were facing higher labor costs than businesses that were in Mexico or even in Moore County. And so that was certainly a factor that people would fear for a business that is largely based on materials and skilled labor. For us, when we looked at it, the preliminary screen was to see, is there enough profits in the business to justify being able to do a buyout? A buyout always involves taking on some level of debt. A business that has no profits can never pay that debt back. So that profits in a buyout situation are absolutely critical no matter who it is.
Sure.
And we felt like there were sufficient profits there. The business had not lost money for any consistent period of time. It had lost money for like 1 year, which meant that it was from the projects we'd looked at, was an easy turnaround. The level of decay in the business was not very substantial, because it just hadn't been. I mean, we would see businesses in 1982 that had lost money for 10 consecutive years or for 5 consecutive years, and they were already severely weakened.
Martin, who did the research for you? I mean, the actual research and looking at these books. Was this something that you did hands-on, or was this something that Crawford...
There were 3 key people on the self-help side who worked on this project. Myself, a fellow named Steve Zuckerman, who is a very smart, very young fellow, a Yale graduate who'd gone to Bain Consulting, a big consulting firm in Boston, and then came here before he went back to Stanford Business School, and now he's running a big investment banking firm in San Francisco. And Crawford, Renshaw, the 3 of us.
And your basic assessment was?
Very, totally viable. It was viable as a business. It needed new leadership. We felt like Sam could contribute, but that he was not the CEO potential for the next couple of decades. And we sort of took that issue head on. So we were going to bring in an outside party to supplement the leadership needs of the business. The next level of analysis, really, Crawford did primarily himself. He came in and basically did a product-by-product assessment of profitability. What you will find in businesses that have lost control is that they will show you that product-by-product, every product is making a huge profit, but somehow the company as a whole is losing money. And so that means that the analytic assessment of the business is faulty. There's something, a mistake being made. So Crawford went through and basically analyzed the basic contribution of the profit lines, the product lines, to see which ones could continue, which ones could you expand. Because if you don't know that basic data, you don't know which things to expand and which to contract within a company. The second piece of analyzing the technical side of the business was to understand the tax implications. Our plan was to use an ESOP structure, an employee stock ownership plan, as the method for employees to buy out the former owners. And the critical thing for an ESOP plan to work, there are 2 or 3 critical factors. One is the business has to have profits, because you don't have any tax. The tax benefits of an ESOP don't accrue unless there's profit in the business. White Furniture just hadn't, there was just no question that was strong potential. It had profits forever. The second piece was that you had to have a firm that is at least 50 employees in size to be able to justify the administration costs of doing an ESOP, because you have to do annual appraisals of the stock, and you basically are going to have between $10,000 and $15,000 of expenses, $10,000 to $25,000 of expenses each year to maintain an employee stock ownership plan, which is like a retirement plan, but the employees own the stock in the company. And basically what that allows you to do, this is probably more technical than you will ever want or need, but it basically allowed the profits of the business to pay off the debt in a pre-tax form, so that it basically means you can have a cushion of somewhere of around 40%, 40 to 50% greater than a traditional buyer of a company could have. So that all other things equal, a traditional purchaser of this plant versus a tax-favored employee buyout, you have a 40% advantage in doing it as an employee. roughly, which basically for us, our sense was there's no way that if these, there is no way if you have comparable management that a outside purchaser can compete with an employee buyout if you have comparable leadership.
What about the capital necessary to upgrade the equipment within the factory? If that needed to be done, it might be available for, with an outside purchaser that might not be available with an ESOP.
An ESOP has the ability to borrow better and more than an outside purchaser. So again, someone would have to judge the viability of whether or not the plan was viable and whether or not the people carrying it out, which I think is a totally valid critique of the effort that we were doing of saying, well, how experienced is Crawford at this level? You know, he's done all these other things that he's been a superstar at.
On the point of, did White Furniture have any debt at that point?
I don't remember it having any substantial debt at all. I mean, I have files. I haven't had a chance to go look and see if I have my old file.
The street rumor was that they had never borrowed money, that they had never, you know, believed in that. I'm being coached to project.
To speak up loud.
I had heard that they had, you know, from folks that they had were one of those old-fashioned companies that had never borrowed. Would that make more desirable as well, that they would have no debt when you're looking at a company?
Well, it makes it easier.
Yeah.
It makes it easier if you have assets there, and with the primary assets of White Furniture at that point, the financial assets were its plant and equipment, and then a huge amount of inventories. They had tons and tons of wood in inventory. I mean, we believed that there was that there was a substantial amount of the purchase price that was in the inventories of wood. It was huge.
We have heard another rumor. I can test rumors. I can set you up with this, but this is what I have heard, was that there was enough inventory in the plant at the time of purchase to pay for the purchase price in and of itself. Is that something that
we would have had
to, or is that something that could you tell us where to look to document something like that?
We would have had that data, and I'll need to go back and try to see if I can find my files or someone who was there contemporaneously. I believe that that's true. I just, you know, I'm trying to remember 10 years ago. But our sense was that the plant obviously needed substantial work, so that the plant itself was not a major a value asset. This was before the environmental issues. I think it was just before that became a really major issue for lenders, so that facility would have anything that existed for 100 years as an industrial site would today be very suspect for environmental hazards. And I can't remember exactly when that came in. But our sense was that there were several things that an outside buyer, I mean, basically the dynamic that took place was the Millenders were pushing. The White family, from my perspective, was very passive. I mean, it was a very southern genteel, that dealing with real avid lawyerly conflict was something that they just had never encountered before and did not know exactly what do we do and how quickly can we respond. And they may have been, the Millenders may have been shut out of information. And so I think they had a fear that if it weren't sold now, that the business would deteriorate and go into bankruptcy and their stock holdings would be worthless. So that was the mindset from my perspective, from a distance.
You put together a proposal?
We put together a proposal. If I as best I remember it, we were going to buy the plant for somewhere in the $6 million range. And we're going to have debt that would be secured by the assets as part of the buyout, and use this tax-favored ESOP and bring in a new CEO to the plant. It would have, I believe to this day, that it would have worked really well.
And what happened?
Well, basically it became a battle, and I can't remember, again, without some prodding, all of the sequential steps, that it became clear who the bidder was, and I can't remember what the name of his company. I can't remember whether it was Hickory Chair at that point, or whether it was, you know, Clyde Engel owned dozens and dozens of different hierarchical, very complicated corporations. And we were essentially competing with a proposal. And I guess there was always the third proposal, which was to do nothing and to continue as it was. And the weak spot, I mean, in retrospect, the two critical weak spots that I think are really fair critiques of the self-help proposal at that point was that we didn't have all the financing lined up. We needed to have the company's cooperation. We could not do it as a hostile takeover. We were not interested in that kind of scenario. But we had very strong contacts with Chemical Bank and Citicorp and large lenders, so that I believe we would have put that together. I mean, we have since then, self-help has done significant financial transactions. We had the access and contacts to do that, but we didn't have that money to put on the table like we could now. I mean, we didn't have $77 million that we could invest. If we had, I think we would have done that project. And then the leadership, I think, that we had was less tested than the leadership of a Hickory Chair corporation. The pluses were that we had the tax-favored treatment and we had a much stronger commitment to the local economy. There were reasons that... and we felt like we knew exactly what would happen after... we did a literature search just really as a lark and were the first to uncover the Fortune article on Clyde Engel. And so we delivered that to the plant, and we did a bunch of other research on the 10K filings, which are the Securities and Exchange Commission filings, and all of a sudden we're saying, hey, this guy is not a pristine, pure industry operator of furniture, that he has been alleged to have milked pension plans. And there was certainly the assessment at White Furniture that the pension plan there had the potential of overfunding, of pulling out $1 million to $2 million, we believed. And I have no idea what actually happened because I didn't track it after the event, but we felt like there was the potential for an amount of money to come out of the pension plan, which was certainly the allegations that the SEC and others had made against Clyde Engel and a bunch of other companies. He did have a pattern of having companies that he took over 5 years later filing bankruptcy and looking for what happened to the assets of that company. We felt like what would happen with White Furniture is the inventories would be depleted, there'd be a gradual sell-off of the most sellable assets, that there could be some reassessment of the pension plan overfunding situation, and that basically there would be the potential of pulling the purchase price back out of the business and leaving the carcass to rot. Now, I can't say that is exactly what happened, but that's what we believed would happen. And they're at least pieces of it, without knowing all the facts, without knowing what happened to the inventories, without knowing what happened to the pension plan. We certainly saw them sell the Hillsborough plant, which was far more modern than the one in Mebane.
Well, given...
It was a rape.
Well, given this context you've just set up, was there, and especially the commitment to the local economy that you've described, were the Whites or the Mellenders more sympathetic to your proposal just out of those interests?
Well, we were very young, so we had a credibility hoop to overcome. And I think Carter and Zan were not the most... they had a credibility hurdle within their own family. And I think it was a very gradual thing that people were saying, well, let's go with a surefire thing. Someone from within the industry, there was a consultant who had been hired. There was a very high-powered law firm from Charlotte who, I don't fault as much now as I did then, who was very strong or very experienced in how you do these mergers. They were using a mechanism called a cash-out merger, which basically says if you have a majority vote, you can force all the other shareholders to sell out. There's no majority completely rules. And they were good. And so we were really a little bit out of our league in that negotiation process. And yet, what we had uncovered was that this is not your bona fide, pristine purchaser of like industry type. And so that really created a firestorm. And so we were in there basically at midnight in my living room trying to figure out, okay, how do we fight for fight with these lawyers? And it was procedural battles. It became like a hostile proxy battle. And what that means is there was a day that we had this big shareholder vote. I was there. And their lawyer was there, and they were running it. And the vote was very, very close. I mean, I don't know exactly what it came out to, but my memory, it was like 54% to 46%. Of all the different, so all the Mellender family voted to sell it.
Were they all there at this?
Everyone was there.
Voted to sell it to you?
No, voted to sell it to the Hickory chair. And the White family, I think along that way, they were sort of measuring between these two evils. And in their mind, I think this young group that could have an answer that seemed smart, seemed to have an answer, and certainly had information about the other guys that were was very damaging. And then another party who seemed to have lots of good industry solidity, but all of a sudden who looks like they're rapists. And so ultimately the majority of the White family voted against the sale. And I just, this is anecdotal, I wish I could remember it exactly, but I believe the swing vote was Sam. I believe his stock was voted that was the vote that made it be sold, and that he had the impression, which is, again, if you're experienced, that's what people do when they're doing buyouts, is they dangle not the commitment that they will keep you as the manager, but the possibility. And that Sam was looking at whether or not he kept his job. I may be wrong in that, so that really needs to be verified. But there was in the mid-40s% that voted against it, and it was not until that day that it was clear. I mean, it was not until the vote was finished that it was clear that we had lost and Hickory chair had won. And it was in one of those meetings where I was standing up and saying, these guys are corporate raiders and pillagers, and maybe just whatever strong language I could have, that their lawyer said, and I think a measure of protectiveness to me that I don't, you know, I don't know whether he liked his clients or not, but he was a professional in his work of saying, you need to be very careful in the language you're using. This person has sued people for libel before. He has plenty of money to wipe you out. Just be very circumspect in how you present this case. And I was saying, you know, it's not like Fortune magazine is some pinko publication that is far left or anything. I mean, this is mainstream American business journal that...
Yeah, let me just flip the tape. I don't want to break the momentum here, but...